What? I wanted to get back to this other little corroborating instance, because I frankly, Mr. Clark, with due deference to your scientific knowledge, which is vastly in excess of mine, I wanted to point out another sighting, however, of a UFO by a research engineer of the Air Force Missile Development Center near Alamogordo. At about that same time.
What date was that again?
This was on November 4th, the following day.
Last November.
Yes, this past November. Mm-hmm. Stokes, this research engineer, had seen a huge elliptically shaped object which appeared between the center and White Sands. As it passed near the highway he was on, it had cut out his radio, stopped his engine, and those of 10 other cars. Now, Stokes estimated this UFO at about 500 foot diameter, which is a pretty big ship, and he said as it went by at its lowest point, he could feel a wave of heat. Now, how would you explain this? The same way? Nervous foot?
Well, now, in these cases, you're helpless until you can go there and interrogate the people. You have to rely on your sources of information. I don't know what the source is in this case. I have to rely on the fact that whenever this happens, the Air Force sends its officers there to interrogate people. And they've spent, I guess, millions of dollars by now interrogating everyone who's claimed to have seen anything like this. And I think any reasonable person has to accept the statements of the administration through the Air Force that after analyzing all these cases, they don't believe there are any extraterrestrial phenomena involved. This is all. If one doesn't accept this explanation, then one has to assume that the Air Force is committing perjury.
Court is flipping the pages looking for
now,
the portal again.
Yes. Now, I know the Air Force has made a complete hash of the flying saucer investigation in the early days because they didn't know what was going on, and they went every which way. But I think that now the matter has been resolved.
Major Aho.
Regarding this discussion of military personnel and what the Air Force is doing, etc., I'm aware that there are a number of things about this New Mexico situation that have not come altogether to light. But I'm also aware that in the military service, it makes a great deal of difference whether you're on active duty or whether you're retired. And I am aware, and many others are aware, that such people as Rear Admiral Farney, retired, who was former guided missiles chief of the Navy, upon retirement made a public statement that flying saucers are real, that these UFOs are real, and that he doesn't know where they're coming from except that they're coming from out in space.
When you say they're real, in other words, you mean they are interplanetary?
Not necessarily interplanetary, but that, I think that he meant by that they are real objects, that they are, he mentioned in this public release that they are controlled objects.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an indication of a great technology involved, and it must have taken a long time to develop this technology. And by that statement, I felt that he was implying that there was definitely life and intelligence involved, and possibly coming from other planets.
Oh, in other words, you feel that he implied this?
Yes.
He didn't actually make this. What, did he actually make the statement that the flying saucers are real?
Yes.
Is this his
That's
statement?
Right.
He said they were controlled, which is even more important.
I have his statement right here, just as it happened. It's a very short one,
please.
Reliable reports indicate that there are objects coming into our atmosphere at very high speeds. The way they change position in formation would indicate that their motion is directed. As long as they continue to navigate through the Earth's atmosphere, there is an urgent need to know the facts.
Who's I missed that?
Admiral Delmar S. Farney, U.S. Navy, retired.
I would agree with everything in that statement. I think that is a simple statement
of
fact.
What did he say?
That objects are entering space from the atmosphere and that they are directed.
Yes,
and we ought to know what they are.
He said more than that. On a nationwide news release, January 7, 1957, He said that there was a definite high technology involved, and it must have taken a long time to develop, and that these objects were definitely controlled. Now, if we were relying on the statement of one retired admiral who had a very responsible position in the military service...
What did he do?
He was former guided missiles chief of the Navy.
Oh, I see. I hope
that's a responsible position.
It is.
Yes.
Another person upon retirement from the military service, Vice Admiral Hillencoutter, former director of Central Intelligence, and certainly here is a man that should know. If we consider intelligence, Central Intelligence as being an important agency, why? And I think we do concede that it is an important agency in American military set up in the American government. Why did Vice Admiral Hillencoutter become a director of NICAP, the organization that Major Donald Kehoe directs in Washington, D.C.? Why did
it? Is that a question?
Yes.
Do you know the answer to it?
Well, I feel that I do. He also has made a statement that these objects are real and that the American public should be informed about it.
You know, one thing, Major Ahoe, this may be a very stupid question, and when you do this 7 nights during the week, you're bound to hit a few stupid ones. Do you believe in some of the contact stories? And I'm not going to ask you which ones now.
Let's put it this way, John. It's very difficult for me to put myself in a position to say, well, I will support this one, or I will...
No, I don't. I'm not going to ask you that. This is not a trick question.
Yes.
Do you believe that flying saucers with Venusians or Martians have landed someplace in the States here, and that some of the citizens of the United States have spoken to these people and even possibly have had a ride in a saucer?
I would like to summarize the situation in this manner, that all through history, mankind has been very, very stubborn about accepting any kind of change or any new idea, I don't care what it is. There was a time when it was believed that the Earth was the center of the universe, and that the Earth was the center of the solar system. And every time that a scientist or astronomer, whoever it was, came out with a new idea, he was met by ridicule and opposition from all directions.
Is this a new idea?
No, it's
a little bit different than an astronomer, somebody coming up with a new idea. This is a man who the following day contacts his neighbors and he says, Joe, last night a saucer landed in the backyard and a couple of Venusians came in and broke bread with me.
We have a lot more to go on than that.
More than that we have to go?
Much more to go on than that. We have a situation today where there are thousands of these sighting reports coming from all over the world. And many by astronomers. I have before me
Major Ahoe, pardon me, I'm sorry to interrupt. I wonder if you could answer that question a moment. Because we're going to be here for a long while, but I'd just like to have an answer to that question. Should I repeat it?
No, I know what your question is. But I would like to include with the possibility that contacts have been established.
It's strictly a possibility. It isn't a fact in your mind.
No, it's a definite possibility.
It's a possibility in mind. I think it's a possibility in any intelligent man's mind.
And the fact that we have had thousands of sighting reports coming in from all over the world, and these statements that these objects are intelligently controlled, and the statements that Mr. Clark made that there's in his belief that we may have been visited before, then I don't think that we should just cancel this thing out and say that for some reason, without any definite logic or investigation, we have to cancel out these sighting reports. I think that they are part of the evidence. And when you begin to put the whole picture together, the thousands of sighting reports, the radar reports, the photographs that have been taken, and there are hundreds of photographs available in color, in moving pictures, And I would say that the military services of the world have thousands, running perhaps into the hundreds of thousands of photographs. If we put all of this together, and then we put these contact stories together, and examine them, examine the witnesses, the report they witnessed these contacts taking place, we may have an intelligent program, something to go by.
Major Ahold, there's only one brief comment I'd like to make. And that is, it would seem to me that if our government had as much knowledge about this thing, about these things, as we seem to have around this table here 7 nights during the week, I don't know what they're fooling around at Cape Canaveral tonight, down in Florida, when it would be just a matter, I would rather stall a little while and say, well, look, maybe we can schmooze with one of these Venusians or Martians. Maybe it'll be next week, maybe it'll be a month from now, and we'll make a deal, and we'll get, you know, the inside, and it'll make Sputnik look like a large nothing.
Yeah, I think Major has really proved my point beautifully. If there are thousands of reports of contacts, that proves practically conclusively that contacts do not occur. If there are only 2 or 3 reports of contacts, those might be real. But if thousands of people report them and nothing, and they're never proved, that proves that whatever they're reporting has some other explanation.
You see, I don't think that goes by at all, though, Mr. Clark, because all during the Middle Ages, the peasants were reporting meteors.
And they're reporting witches, too.
They're reporting meteors. These are actual physical things.
Yes, and, no, don't confuse the issue. Don't confuse the UFOs and the landing of soldiers.
I was citing your reasoning there, as I don't think that's conclusive at all.
No, you haven't got my... I'm afraid you misunderstood me.
Well,
if you report seeing things and meeting... And I'm referring to contacts, reports of contacts. Now, contacts are such... If they exist, they're so extraordinary and so important that if even a few of them occur... That will very quickly be settled positively without any doubt whatsoever. I could believe if a few people reported actual contacts, just a few people, I might believe them. But when thousands of people report contacts, yet this is not conclusively proved, then it cannot be happening.
I have a question along that line that I've weighed in my mind many times when I get into a discussion with people, say, well, certain stories just can't possibly be true, that they're too fantastic, etc. I would like to ask the question, Mr. Clark, that if you had a contact with a spaceship, how would you convince the people of the world that this contact was real, that you had really had this contact?
This is an excellent question.
I'm glad you asked.
I'm glad you asked that, Senator. I've often thought about this. Now, first of all, I'm a photographer, and I'm relying on the photographic evidence. One of the first things I would do, of course, is to shoot off any number of rolls of film.
Providing...
If I had a camera with me.
And providing that the Venusians or the Martians would permit this.
Well, now, there's no reason why they shouldn't. I would just walk over a few steps, have anything to do with them if they wouldn't permit it.
You would really?
Well, I admit I succumb to temptation. I hope I...
No picture, no laundry, Matt.
But I'll try and hang on to them somehow and try and get a picture of them.
You would sneak it out with your buttonhole camera.
That's right.
Very good. Well, they might blank the film with the radiation.
Well, why should they do this? I mean, the point is...
Unconsciously. I mean, you know...
I would like to, if I hope that you gentlemen don't mind this suggestion, but I'd like to take a few minutes with Mr. Clark, and I think that the rest of you gentlemen will possibly be interested in this, too, about the making of a moon. I thought possibly you could give us some of the information, Mr. Clark. I know that is the subject that you are lecturing on, and very frankly, we're not trying to blow the entire lecture by any means. But I'd like to have some information about that. Possibly you can tell us some things.
Well, that was the, it was first of all the title of my book on the satellite program, which has just been revised and reissued in certainly the post-Sputnik editions out now, and it is also the title of my lecture program. I had
Who's
to give
the publisher?
Harper's, they publish all my nonfiction, my underwater books as well as my space books. Well, in that I've traced the history of the idea of satellites And incidentally, it seems that the first man ever to conceive of a satellite was a New Englander, a Boston man, Edward Everett Hale, who wrote a book in the 1870s called The Brick Moon. And some of Hale's ideas were surprisingly modern and up-to-date. And I've traced it from that up to the current epoch, the interest in satellites as research vehicles, culminating now, of course, in their launching by the USSR and by the United States.
How do you compare our satellite with that of Russia's?
Well, of course, there's no doubt about it. The Russian satellite is technically a far superior achievement. I mean, it is a tremendous...
Talking about number one or number two?
Number two. Well, number one, of course, is...
Even number one is superior.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Though, in a year or so, we should be able to do the same thing as the Russians have done. But then, of course, what the Russians have done in a year is another matter to gain.
Mm-hmm. Charles?
Arthur, there's one thing about satellites. In fact, there are several questions. Immediately, satellites are brought up. In fact, when the first Sputnik started swooping overhead, people were saying, and a few that I managed to get in contact with at the time, thought, oh my, there's this big Russian satellite zooming over New York City, and who knows, maybe at any moment it will drop a bomb or something, you know, we are in great danger. And I, perhaps in ignorance, said, hoping to clear this up, that if they did drop a bomb, it wouldn't do them much good because it would burn up before it got here. Now, am I right or wrong on that? If a satellite, suppose they had loaded Sputnik 2 instead of with a dog, they had put maybe a little atomic warhead in there and figured out, three times around back to press the trigger so it would hit New York City. Would it ever get here?
Sure, if they've solved a reentry problem, and there's no little doubt they have, we've solved it. The problem of preventing the thing burning up, there are several ways of doing that. You have a specially shaped nose, or sort of rounded, blunt nose, which diverts the heat away from the warhead itself, and you also have ceramic heat insulating materials, and in these various ways you can get your payload back into the atmosphere.
In other words, a satellite could be used for war-making purposes. It could drop bombs. Seems an awful complicated way to go about it.
The word drop is rather misleading. I mean, if you don't drop a thing from the satellite, you have to bring it down its spirals into the atmosphere. The drop may take you right around the world, perhaps a couple of times. But the existence of Sputnik 2 is proof that they can land a warhead anywhere they like on the surface of the Earth. I don't know with what accuracy, and they probably don't know, but they can get it down within, say, 10, 20 miles anywhere they like on Earth.
Well, this Sputnik is not outside of the Earth's gravitational field, is it?
Oh, no.
In other words, it still maintains the orbit there.
Oh, quite. Right? I mean, nothing is outside the Earth's gravitational field, and up where Sputnik 2 is, Earth's gravity is still about 90% as powerful as it is here at Earth at sea level. I mean, it's Earth's gravity that keeps it in orbit. If it wasn't for gravity, it would just shoot out into space.
That's right.
There's another question that I also hear in the war-making aspects of satellites. People seem to be worried about violating air sovereignty and so forth, particularly with the fact that satellites may be going over as observation vehicles, not observation of space conditions, but observation of ground conditions. And I wondered how much observation you could do at 18,000 miles an hour.
Well, the speed doesn't matter, because I have seen photographs taken from jet planes traveling at 600 miles an hour at treetop level that were pin sharp. So the speed doesn't affect it at all. The trouble is the atmosphere and clouds and that kind of thing. But there's no doubt that you could put reconnaissance equipment, long-range cameras, in a satellite, which could give you invaluable information, particularly about the movement of surface vessels, for example.
On the ocean movement?
On the ocean, yes, they could spot all ocean movements, except when there was cloud cover.
There was one thing, speaking of warlike satellites, you didn't mention any of these points, but there was one point that intrigued me considerably in the lecture, when you talked about the shrapnel technique.
Satellite.
Yeah, this. Would you explain that again? That was quite fascinating.
Well, there have been a lot of suggestion that we might build, or somebody might build, space fortresses which could be used to dominate the Earth and perhaps as launching platforms to threaten the world. But I think that if such fortresses were built, they could be destroyed so very much more easily than they could be constructed, that they would be worthless militarily. And the way you could destroy them easily is this. The satellite, of course, the space fortress, has a fixed orbit, and you know just where it is at any moment. Just going round and round, it'd be a spectacularly visible object in the sky, even to the naked eye, much brighter than Sputnik 2, to be the brightest thing in the sky. If you want to destroy it, all you do is to shoot up into the same orbit, but in the opposite direction. A warhead loaded with old-fashioned shrapnel. And somewhere as it goes around the orbit, it could be on the other side of the Earth from the space fort, you explode this warhead and the shrapnel scatters. It uses quite a small charge of explosive. And it forms a cloud of particles, a cloud of shot, if you like, which will then meet the space fortress head-on twice every revolution, in other words, about every 45 minutes or so, at a total combined speed of about 30,000 miles an hour, say 10 times as fast as a rifle bullet. So if you miss the first time, 45 minutes later, you have another go at it. And every 45 minutes, the space fortress sails through this cloud of shrapnel. Exactly.
You know, I wish we were half as ingenious at prolonging life and doing something for mankind.
Yeah, I quite agree with you. And I hope, incidentally, that space stations may help us to prolong life. There's some good evidence for thinking that under low gravity conditions, and of course in a space station you have zero gravity, that men might live longer. And certainly that men suffering from various, perhaps heart disease and muscular diseases, might live normal lives. And I think that the medical results of building space stations may be quite important.
I skipped a point. Didn't you say before that the Earth's gravity was just as strong out there as it is down here?
It's a little weaker. It's still about 90%. It falls off a distance, but very slowly. So at the distances of the present satellites, it's still quite strong. For instance, you have to go out 4,000 miles before it falls to a quarter of its sea level value here.
Yeah, well, you were planning on or at least conjecturing, a space station considerably farther out than that, then, where you could be benefited.
That's another thing. In a space vehicle at any distance from the Earth, there is no feeling of gravity. You're under the pull of gravity, but you don't feel it because you are falling freely. Now, this is a difficult conception, but here, right here on the Earth's surface, you can be weightless. You can have no sensation of gravity. If you're in an elevator and the lift and the cable breaks, you're fully under the influence of gravity, but you're weightless as long as you're falling, you see.
Yeah,
you don't stay weightless for long.
Sure.
But in a space station, even if it's only a couple of hundred miles up, where gravity is very nearly the same as it is here, the total force of gravity, you would feel weightless because you are falling freely all the time around the Earth. So you have to distinguish between these two facts. That you can have this weightlessness or so-called gravityless feeling, even when gravity is there.
Why would this be beneficial to our health, or at least possibly be beneficial?
Well, think of all the work we do against gravity here on the Earth's surface, moving our bodies around, climbing upstairs, and this must definitely shorten our lives to some extent.
But what would happen if we had no gravitational pull?
Well, wouldn't I
be floating?
You would float around, and you wouldn't...
How would I control myself, though? In other words, I don't want to go upstairs. I want to stay right here.
Okay, well, I'm afraid you have to have belts, but you have to have seat straps if you want to sit down in one place. But you remember, we can build space stations, so you can have gravity in one part, or a sort of artificial gravity in one part, and no gravity in another part. It's a very simple trick. All you do is you design your space station like a big wheel, and it rotates slowly. And if you adjust the rate of rotation, you can have things so that centrifugal force gives you a normal feeling of gravity at the rim of the wheel. As you go towards the hub, the center of the wheel, you have no gravity. So you just...
What would happen to all of the objects that we may have, like on a table here, the packages of cigarettes, the microphones and things, wouldn't these be floating in the air?
Or would they
go right to the ceiling?
You have those things in the section of the space station where there's gravity. You have them on the rim of the space station. That's where you do your cooking, and you have your showers, and you prepare your meals, and you sit down. Things are perfectly normal there. But when you go towards the center of the space station, your apparent weight, because you're no longer rotating so quickly, our apparent weight falls off, and at the center of the station, you have no weight.
When we come to
the hub,
we would start to float?
You would float around in the hub. That's right.
Well, Well, if we were in a room, then, would I be on the ceiling?
There is no ceiling.
In a room, there wouldn't be a ceiling?
There are just six walls. There's no up or down. There's no preferred direction. In the hub of the space station, there's no gravity. There's no up or down. There are just six walls around you.
Well, what would be the purpose of walking into this hub?
Well, you couldn't walk there, actually. You'd drift. It'd be like underwater. It's like underwater. And one reason why I'm interested in underwater exploring and spend most of my time there is this is the nearest thing you can get to the gravity-free condition of a space station.
Yes, but would you want to live underwater? This wouldn't be comfortable, would
it? I'm only very happy underwater.
You came to the right program,
right. Arthur, there's one question I would like to get in. I have read, it may have been even one of your books, I don't know, not only the various weightlessness phenomena, but the fact that in a weightless condition of free fall, a number of curious things happens, among which, as I recall, is the fact that unless you're very careful, if you're in a weightless condition, you might suffocate in your own breath. Now, what is the function there?
Yes, so the point is that when we breathe out, the air is heated and it rises away from us normally here on Earth. But in a space station, it couldn't rise because there'd be no gravity. But this is no problem. You simply have to have a very slight amount of forced ventilation. You have to have fans to keep the air changing around anyway. So there's no real danger of suffocating because your exhaled air wouldn't drift away from you.
Quite.
Well, now, if you don't have to exert any effort, what about our muscles? Would they not atrophy, possibly?
This could be a danger, but you might have to take a certain amount of exercise to overcome this. But I'm thinking specifically of people who have muscular defects and can't get around, and perhaps even multiple amputees, for instance, might be able to operate, at least men who've lost their legs, they might be able to operate perhaps even better under these conditions than normal men could, because they wouldn't have so much useless weight to drag around.
Well, why? Oh, excuse me, Major.
Major?
I'd like to make a comment on this gravity situation. We always talk about opposing gravity or blasting off into space or neutralizing gravity or the power of the motor and the energy that is needed to establish these space stations and put satellites into orbit, etc. And man has at various times found that it's very helpful to work with the forces of nature. Do you think that there is a possibility that we can learn how to use gravity for power and rather than oppose it, use it like we use water power, you might say, as an energy?
Well, I don't see how you can use gravity, get power out of gravity, but I think we may one day be able to control gravity in some way or neutralize it, but we shall need power to do it. For instance, if you consider the problem of getting away from the Earth, there's a certain amount of power, a certain amount of energy required for the job, and it doesn't matter how you do it, whether you go by rocket or any other conceivable device, there's a minimum amount of energy needed for the job. This is, if you climb over a mountain, if you travel over a mountain, doesn't you have to do a certain amount of work, whether you walk, whether you travel by bicycle or automobile or airplane. And one day we may be able to control gravity and go away from the Earth much more comfortably and with less flame and fury than at present. But we shall soon need a source of power, perhaps of nuclear energy or something like that.
Arthur, I wonder if you put any credence talking about controlling gravity. Do you know about the experiments of Roger Babson? Is he still doing them, or do you know of
the Gravity Research Foundation?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if he's ever done any experiments. He's set up a fund, didn't he, to collect material on gravity.
Well, as I understand, he had offered a prize for anyone who, quite a substantial prize,
yes,
for anyone who could find an anti-gravitic substance, and that, in fact, at his research center against gravity, I guess you might call it, they were doing a fairly methodical technique of sort of suspending things in the air and holding various substances under in the hope that, you know, like maybe you'd hold a plate of fried eggs under and who knows, maybe it just wouldn't fall that time, and you have it.
Well, there's a lot of work going on in various research laboratories to see if we can find anything about gravity. But an anti-gravitic substance of the type that, for instance, Wells had in his story, The First Man in the Moon, so a gravity shield, it's quite easy to show that is impossible. It violates the law of the conservation of energy. On the other hand, it's theoretically perfectly possible to have a substance which has negative gravity. In other words, it goes up. It's repelled by ordinary matter. That's a different thing altogether. That might be theoretically possible. But a gravity shield is not possible unless it is powered by an external power source.
Well, when you speak of the matter with negative gravity, this gets into science fictional concepts.
Well,
but wouldn't this, as I recall the definition of this sort of stuff, this would be negative matter, as a matter of fact.
It might be.
And if it got together with positive matter, isn't the theory that it will
bang.
Be a big boom? Yeah.
That's right.
It
yeah.
wouldn't be too handy to have this stuff around.
It might not be useful.
I don't know.
It wouldn't render the jointure inert, would it?
Well, if this negative matter met ordinary matter, each would annihilate the other, and the result would make a hydrogen bomb seem a very modest performance.
I've had something working around and around in the back of my head here for the last 30 minutes or so, and I must insist to get this out while Mr. Clark is here. We've had quite a bit of discussion about the Earth, the danger of mankind completely wiping himself out on this planet before he becomes intelligent enough to control the things he has created. Also, we have looked back into history, and we have thought about various things that have happened in the past, and the history of the world is not a very beautiful one. It seems like we have had war upon war as long as we have a record of history. And it seems that that many people from time to time have risen to positions of leadership, leading various nations or countries, either as dictators or kings, and down through history we have said later that those men were insane because they plunged their nation and they plunged the world into war at various times. We have discussed these various persons who claim that they have had contacts with spaceships, and we have cast around some ideas as to who is sane and who is not sane. And as I look around me on the Earth and think about these things, and think about our nuclear program and our present ideas that we about our next step with the nuclear bombs is to blast a bomb off into space, explode them out 50 miles out, or perhaps one on the moon, and blow bits, hunks off the moon and hope that they will float back to Earth so we can examine them, and things of that nature. And something that George Bernard Shaw said comes to mind. He said that the Earth is the lunatic asylum of the solar system. And I just wonder if perhaps maybe this might be true, that most of Earth people are actually lunatics, and that perhaps the Earth might be off limits to people from other planets, and that's why perhaps they don't land in the middle of a populated area or contact the president or contact some king or emperor. Because maybe the Earth people are just in such a state of development that they're not safe to contact.
Charles?
I wonder what, to get in this, I may say that Mr. Clark is a unique authority on the ideas of George Bernard Shaw, because I happen to have seen some correspondence from Mr. Shaw to Mr. Clark. And as I recall, Arthur, there were some rather peculiar ideas in this correspondence, weren't there, that Mr. Shaw was putting forth about gravity and vacuum and rocket experiments?
Well, before you answer that question, Mr. Clark, let me just tell our listeners again that this is WOR Radio, your station in New York, and this is Long John with the Party Line.
First, could I make a slight correction, Joe? You said that Harper's published my books. Well, they published all my nonfiction, but I have a large number of other publishers who may be a little...
I'm sorry, you made the statement.
No. Harper's do my nonfiction, but Gnome Press, Valentine Books, and Harcourt Brace have done my fiction. As to the points that a Major raised, including his very interesting one about the idea of the Earth as a sort of lunatic asylum, I think that's a very plausible theory. And one of my novels, Childhood's End, was, in a sense, based on this idea that... we are ripe to be taken over and run properly. However, as far as Shaw is concerned, it's an interesting story about 10 years ago now, when I was at King's College London, I wrote a paper on space travel and its social effects, and I sent a copy of this to Shaw because I quoted the concluding lines, I believe, from Back to Methuselah, the last chapter of that, as far as mine can reach, is quite relevant to this subject. And Shaw was quite impressed by this paper and wrote back to me. I still have the correspondence, and promptly joined the Interplanetary Society. It was quite remarkable that at that age, he would be about 92, I think, then. He was still so active-minded that he was interested in this development of space travel.
Major, any further comments?
Well, I'm just inclined to go right along. This is perhaps the answer why we don't have one land in the middle of one of our populated cities or contact one of our leaders, because the destructive forces that we have built here, enough to destroy all of the civilization on this planet, I think that's pretty well agreed. The question would be, what would we do if we had something further, if we don't learn how to control these things and use our technology for the benefit of society, for the benefit of mankind, rather than for destruction?
I've often wondered, Major Ahol, why it is that so many people who believe in saucers are under the impression that the Venusians and the Martians and members, or rather citizens of the planet Clarion, some people are not familiar with that planet, it's behind the moon, I've often wondered why these people who believe in flying saucers are so sold on the idea that the Venusians and Martians are actually interested in doing us only good.
No, I don't think that that's a general, should generally be applied to all people that are interested in the flying saucer subject. I'm rather of the opinion myself that if we're going to grow, we're going to have to grow ourselves. And there might be such a thing that from this visitation, this touch-and-go business, touch-and-go landings and the sightings and so forth, are merely to arouse our curiosity, so we will learn that there is something bigger, something greater in the universe.
That they're sort of playing a game with us?
That's right. These are
intelligent people that are far superior to us as far as intelligence is concerned, and they're running these things around these saucers
just to show us that there is something that we can investigate and
is
learn about.
Is this a display of love for your fellow man and that sort of thing?
No, I think it's a display of a natural law that if you're going to grow, every person has to make an individual effort to do that growing.
Are you talking about individuals now, Major?
I'm talking about
nations.
I'm talking about individuals, and from individuals it becomes families, and from families it becomes communities, and from communities, nations, and an international community.
Right here on this planet, Major Ahol, it seems to me that I have heard from time to time that it's been suggested that we should exchange ideas. In other words, the Russians should give us all of the facts about Sputniks, and we should give them all the facts about things that we know. And if we could do this, if we could exchange ideas and knowledge that we may have accumulated, we possibly wouldn't have wars. At least I've read this someplace, I know. If this is true, why is it that these super intellects who are coming around in these saucers just playing games with us, why don't they come down and give us the facts, you know? Just say, look, fellas, the whole thing that you're doing here is completely obsolete. These little toys that you have, they look like children's kites that you call jet planes and things like that. Why don't they help us?
Well, perhaps, John, it will come to that point. I think that...
Why is the great delay? This has been going on for over 2,000 or 4,000, I don't know how many thousands of years. Why is it taking so long before they're going to be kind enough as big brothers to come down and help the stupid people?
Well, let's hang the sign right on man's own ignorance. His inability to examine new things with an open mind.
Examine? What chance do we have to examine, Major Ahol?
We have the chance every day. I'm examining. Anyone else can do the same.
You're examining saucers?
Absolutely. And the rule is open for anyone that wants to do the same thing. I know that that many people are making statements about this subject that have not examined very much of the evidence. And they discarded without any examination, said, well, this is all tommyrot.
Well, Major Aho, in other words, when you say that they're giving us a chance and they have for the past 2,000 or 5,000 years gave us the opportunity of examining these things, do you mean that they've just been flying around and that's the extent of the examination that they permitted us to make? In other words, they haven't actually, or are they landing saucers here that I can go over tomorrow afternoon and take a peek at?
I think that it'll, when we begin to understand more of the picture, that it will tie in with the development of the Earth, or a greater technology, the fact that we have become airborne, the fact that we are thinking about going out into space ourselves. Psychologically, now is the time where a man might best understand that there might be life on other planets already. And that he will, when he reaches out into space, he will begin to meet some of that life. But it is obvious to me that the state of conditions on this planet, that if one of these ships and a superior technology fell into the hands of any nation on the Earth that is involved in this Cold War business, that immediately we would want to make war weapons out of these things.
Don't you
think? And again, it comes right down to the same thing that we have greater weapons of destruction. We have greater capabilities of delivering greater destructive power and so forth in warfare. And until a man can overcome warfare, why, a lot of these things are just, they're just taken down rather than up. And I think that we have to learn to control such things as fear and hate and envy and greed and a lot of those things that are human attributes that we just don't seem to be able to get away from. But I think that we're going to have to very soon get away from these, or the civilization is done for.
Well, we've been trying for a number of years. I was just wondering this, though. Don't you think it's rather unfortunate that these wonderful people have permitted us to remain ignorant for so many years?
No, let's not put it that way. Let's say that we have permitted ourselves to remain ignorant. Let's put the blame right on our home doorstep, because someone else cannot educate another person against their will. It's an individual effort, and it will always be an individual effort.
This is an interesting point that I've often thought about. You might argue if these superior beings are around, and as I explained, I don't believe they are, but if they were around, they might in fact hold off, because if you have made contact too soon with a primitive race, you might destroy the morale and spirit of that race in the way that on this planet various backward races have died out after contact with higher races, or at least higher civilizations. I don't believe there are any higher races on this planet. But sort of they get an inferiority complex, a cultural inferiority complex, and die out. This might conceivably happen if we came in contact with a very much superior race to our own.
That's a rather frightening thing.
Incidentally, the question that was raised is if this is a lunatic asylum, this Earth, and our wardens are flying around, all that I want to know is where are the tranquilizers?
Well, I think that there is a point here that's rather interesting. After all, what we are lacking is not perhaps knowledge in physical sciences, material sciences. To me, these things have gone ahead at a tremendous rate, certainly in the last 30 or 40 or 50 years. Ever since, about 50 years ago when the first airplane was successfully gotten off the ground. But our social science, our spiritual science, has not gone far ahead, nor has it proceeded rapidly, nor in any measure kept pace with our development of physical and material sciences. In other words, man has not learned how to live with fellow man. Now, John asked, why don't the space people come down to us and tell us? We spend an evening, Saturday evening, here in this studio talking about law and order. This is one of the basic laws of the universe. I should tell you, you know vastly more about that than I do, Mr. Clark. After all, you studied this. But we must apply that same rule to our own planet here and have the nations of the world live under law and order. In other words, we know much better than we do. And I think this is the problem. I feel as strongly as Wayne does about we've got to do the job ourselves. We've had many prophets. We've had many great men who have told us a better way to live. These words are very intelligent, but we haven't exerted ourselves sufficiently to live by them. How do you feel about that?
I think that's true, and I think that every intelligent race on any planet must eventually come to the point we reach now, and this point is when they succeed in getting control of sufficient natural forces to destroy themselves. And at this point, a race either does destroy itself or it gets through its adolescence and reaches maturity, and then it's probably safe, at least against internal destruction. And it would be very interesting to know how many races, taking the universe as a whole, succeed in making this dangerous transition, and even more interesting to know if we will make it.
Well, you know, this story of Atlantis and Lemuria destroying each other, to me, is not at all impossible nor unlikely. After all, the extent to which, the speed with which we have developed here in this past half century, and if we keep on at this rate and don't learn to live better, I don't think we're going to see another half century by any manner of means. So for some other civilization prior to this, and perhaps a whole number prior to them, if indeed they existed,
yes,
be likely.
Yes, well, I'm thinking of civilization on other stars, on other planetary systems. I don't believe there'd be any earlier civilization on this Earth, because there would have been some archaeological or geological evidence. And certainly there's been no technological civilization on this planet before. Certainly no civilization ever waged nuclear war, because the evidence of that would be very, very obvious. If there'd ever been, say, nuclear war on this planet, the radioactive byproducts would be all over the place, and we would know all about it.
Even though it happened some 20 or 30,000 years ago?
Even if it happened 10 million years ago.
Uh-huh.
Of course, you know that we've just discovered that Atlantis never existed. These corings from the Atlantic have settled that. These new deep-sea corings have settled that point quite conclusively now.
This I hadn't heard about.
Oceanographic work is going all the time. They've got...
I want to get back to this other little corroborating instance, because I frankly, Mr. Clark, with due deference to your scientific knowledge, which is vastly in excess of mine, I wanted to point out another sighting, however, of a UFO by a research engineer of the Air Force Missile Development Center near Alamogordo. At about that same time.
What date was that again?
This was on November 4th, the following day.
Last November?
Yes, this past November.
Mm-hmm.
Stokes, this research engineer, had seen a huge elliptically shaped object which appeared between the center and White Sands. As it passed near the highway he was on, it had cut out his radio, stopped his engine, and those of 10 other cars. Now, Stokes estimated this UFO at about 500-foot diameter, which is a pretty big ship, and he said as it went by at its lowest point, he could feel a wave of heat. Now, how would you explain this? The same way? Nervous foot?
Well, now, in these cases, you're helpless until you can go there and interrogate the people. You have to rely on your sources of information. I don't know what the source is in this case. I have to rely on the fact that whenever this happens, the Air Force sends its officers there to interrogate people. And they've spent, I guess, millions of dollars by now interrogating everyone who's claimed to have seen anything like this. And I think any reasonable person has to accept the statements of the administration through the Air Force that after analyzing all these cases, they don't believe there are any extraterrestrial phenomena involved. This is all one. If one doesn't accept this explanation, then one has to assume that the Air Force is committing perjury. Now, I know the Air Force has made a complete hash of the flying saucer investigation in the early days because they didn't know what was going on, and they went every which way. But I think that now the matter has been resolved.
Major Ahol.
Regarding this discussion of military personnel and what the Air Force is doing, etc., I'm aware that there are a number of things about this New Mexico situation that have not come altogether to light. But I'm also aware that in the military service, it makes a great deal of difference whether you're on active duty or whether you're retired. And I am aware, and many others are aware, that such people as Rear Admiral Farney, retired, who was former guided missiles chief of the Navy, upon retirement made a public statement that flying saucers are real, that these UFOs are real, and that he doesn't know where they're coming from except that they're coming from out in space.
When you say they're real, in other words, you mean they are interplanetary?
Not necessarily interplanetary, but that, I think that he meant by that they are real objects, that they are, he mentioned in this public release that they are controlled objects.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an indication of a great technology involved, and it must have taken a long time to develop this technology. And by that statement, I felt that he was implying that there was definitely life and intelligence involved, and possibly coming from other
planets. Oh, in other words, you feel that he implied this?
Yes.
He didn't actually make this. What did he actually make the statement that the flying saucers are real?
Yes.
Is this his
statement?
He said they were controlled, which is even more important.
I have his statement right here, just as it happened.
Can you
give us? Yes. It's a very short one.
Please.
This is a lot of stuff.
Right.
Reliable reports indicate that there are objects coming into our atmosphere at very high speeds. The way they change position in formation would indicate that their motion is directed. As long as they continue to navigate through the Earth's atmosphere, there is an urgent need to know the facts.
Who's I'm Mr.
Admiral Delmar S. Farney, U.S. Navy, retired.
I would agree with everything in that statement. I think that is a simple statement
of
fact.
What did he say?
That objects are entering space from the atmosphere and that they are directed.
Yes,
and we ought to know what they are.
He said more than that. On a nationwide news release, January 7, 1957, he said that there was a definite high technology involved, and it must have taken a long time to develop, and that these objects were definitely controlled. Now, if we were relying on the statement of one retired admiral who had a very responsible position in the military service...
What did he do?
He was former guided missiles chief of the Navy.
Oh, I see. I
hope
that.
That's a responsible position.
Yes.
Yes.
Another person upon retirement from the military service, Vice Admiral Hillenkoetter, former director of Central Intelligence, and certainly here is a man that should know. If we consider Central Intelligence as being an important agency, why? And I think we do concede that it is an important agency in American military setup in the American government. Why did Vice Admiral Hillenkoetter become a director of NICAP, the organization that Major Donald Kehoe directs in Washington, D.C. Why did
it? Is that a question?
Yes.
Do you know the answer to it?
Well, I feel that I do. He also has made a statement that these objects are real and that the American public should be informed about it.
You know, one thing, Major Ahol. This may be a very stupid question, and when you do this 7 nights during the week, you're bound to hit a few stupid ones. Do you believe in some of the contact stories? And I'm not going to ask you which ones now.
Let's put it this way, John. It's It's very difficult for me to put myself in a position to say, well, I will support this one, or I will...
No, I don't. I'm not going to ask you that. This is not a trick question.
Yes.
Do you believe that flying saucers with Venusians or Martians have landed someplace in the States here, and that some of the citizens of the United States have spoken to these people and even possibly have had a ride in a saucer?
I would like to summarize the situation in this manner, that all through history, mankind has been very, very stubborn about accepting any kind of change or any new idea, I don't care what it is. There was a time when it was believed that the Earth was the center of the universe, and that the Earth was the center of the solar system, and every time that a scientist or astronomer, whoever it was, came out with a new idea, he was met by ridicule and opposition from all directions.
Is this a new idea?
No, it's an opinion.
It's a little bit different than an astronomer, somebody coming up with a new idea. This is a man who the following day contacts his neighbors and he says, Joe, last night a saucer landed in the backyard and a couple of Venusians came in and broke bread with me.
We have a lot more to go on than that.
More than that we have to go
on? Much more to go on than that. We have a situation today where there are thousands of these sighting reports coming from all over the world, and many by astronomers. I have before me
Major Aho, pardon me, I'm sorry to interrupt. I wonder if you could answer that question a moment, because we're going to be here for a long while, but I'd just like to have an answer to that question. Should I repeat it?
No, I know what your question is. But I would like to include with the possibility that contacts have been established.
It's strictly a possibility. It isn't a fact in your mind.
No, it's a definite possibility.
It's a possibility in mine. I think it's a possibility in any intelligent man's mind.
And the fact that we have had thousands of sighting reports coming in from all over the world, and these statements that these objects are intelligently controlled, and the statements that Mr. Clark made that there's in his belief that we may have been visited before, then I don't think that we should just cancel this thing out and say that for some reason, without any definite logic or investigation, we have to cancel out these sighting reports. I think that they are part of the evidence. And when you begin to put the whole picture together, the thousands of sighting reports, the radar reports, the photographs that have been taken, and there are hundreds of photographs available, in color, in moving pictures, and I would say that the military services of the world have thousands, running perhaps into the hundreds of thousands of photographs. If we put all of this together, and then we put these contact stories together, and examine them, examine the witnesses, the report they witnessed these contacts taking place, we may have an intelligent program, something to go by.
Major Aho, there's only one brief comment I'd like to make. And that is, it would seem to me that if our government had as much knowledge about this thing, about these things, as we seem to have around this table here 7 nights during the week, I don't know what they're fooling around at Cape Canaveral tonight, down in Florida.
Right.
When it would be just a matter, I would rather stall a little while and say, well, look, maybe we can schmooze with one of these Venusians or Martians. Maybe it'll be next week, maybe it'll be a month from now, and we'll make a deal and we'll get, you know, the inside, and it'll make Sputnik look like a large nothing.
Yeah, I think Major has really proved my point beautifully. If there are thousands of reports of contacts, that proves practically conclusively that contacts do not occur. If there are only 2 or 3 reports of contacts, those might be real. But if thousands of people report them and nothing, and they're never proved, that proves that whatever they're reporting has some other explanation. You see,
I don't think
argument?
That goes by at all, though, Mr. Clark, because all during the Middle Ages, the peasants were reporting meteors.
And they're reporting witches, too.
reporting meteors. These are actual physical things.
Yes, and, no, don't confuse the issue. Don't confuse the UFOs and the landing of soldiers.
I was citing your reasoning there, as I don't think that's conclusive at all.
No, you haven't got my... I'm afraid you misunderstood me.
Well,
if you report seeing things and meeting... And I'm referring to contacts, reports of contacts. Now, contacts are, if they exist, are so extraordinary and so important that even a few of them occur, that will very quickly be settled positively without any doubt whatsoever. I could believe, if a few people reported actual contacts, just a few people, I might believe them. But when thousands of people report contacts, yet this is not conclusively proved, and it cannot be happening.
I have a question along that line that I've weighed in my mind many times when I get into a discussion with people, say, well, certain stories just can't possibly be true, that they're too fantastic, etc. I would like to ask the question, Mr. Clark, that if you had a contact with a spaceship, how would you convince the people of the world that this contact was real, that you had really had this contact?
This is an excellent question.
I'm glad he asked.
I'm glad you asked that, Senator. I've often thought about this. Now, first of all, I'm a photographer, and I'm very interested in the photographic evidence. One of the first things I would do, of course, is to shoot off any number of rolls of film.
Providing...
If I had a camera, wouldn't I?
And providing that the Venusians or the Martians would permit this.
Well, now, there's no reason why they shouldn't. I would just walk and refuse to have anything to do with them if they wouldn't permit it.
You would really?
Well, I admit I might succumb to temptation. But I hope I...
No picture, no laundry, Matt.
That's right. But I would try and hang on to them somehow and try and get a picture of them.
You would sneak it out with your buttonhole camera.
That's right.
Very good. Well, they might blank the film with the radiation.
Well, why should they do this? I mean, the point is...
Unconsciously. I mean, you know,
I would like to, if I hope that you gentlemen don't mind this suggestion, but I'd like to take a few minutes with Mr. Clark, and I think that the rest of you gentlemen will possibly be interested in this, too, about the making of a moon. I thought possibly you could give us some of the information, Mr. Clark. I know that is the subject that you are lecturing on, and very frankly, we're not trying to blow the entire lecture by any means, but I'd like to have some information about that. Possibly you can tell us some things.
Well, that was the, it was first of all the title of my book on the satellite program, which has just been revised and reissued in certainly the post-Sputnik editions out now, and it is also the title of my lecture program.
I had Who's to give the publisher?
Harper's, they publish all my non-fiction, my underwater books as well as my space books. Well, in that I've traced the history of the idea of satellites. Incidentally, it seems that the first man ever to conceive of a satellite was a New Englander, a Boston man, Edward Everett Hale, who wrote a book in the 1870s called The Brick Moon. And some of Hale's ideas were surprisingly modern and up-to-date. And I've traced it from that up to the current epoch, the interest in satellites as research vehicles, culminating now, of course, in their launching by the USSR and by the United States.
How do you compare our satellite with that of Russia's?
Well, of course, there's no doubt about it. The Russian satellite is technically a far superior achievement. I mean, it is a tremendous...
Talking about number one or number two?
Number two. Well, number one, of course, is still...
Even number one is superior.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Though, in a year or so, we should be able to do the same thing as the Russians have done. But then, of course, what the Russians have done in a year is another matter to gain.
Charles?
Arthur, there's one thing about satellites. In fact, there are several questions. Immediately, satellites are brought up. In fact, when the first Sputnik started swooping overhead, people were saying, and a few that I managed to get in contact with at the time, thought, oh my, there's this big Russian satellite zooming over New York City, and who knows, maybe at any moment it will drop a bomb or something. You know, we are in great danger. And I, perhaps in ignorance, said, hoping to clear this up, that if they did drop a bomb, it wouldn't do them much good because it would burn up before it got here. Now, am I right or wrong in that? If a satellite, suppose they had loaded Sputnik 2 instead of with a dog, they had put maybe a little atomic warhead in there, and figured out, you know, three times around back to press the trigger so it would hit New York City, would it ever get here?
Sure, if they've solved the reentry problem, and there's no little doubt they have, we've solved it. The problem of preventing the thing burning up, there are several ways of doing that. You have a specially shaped nose, or sort of rounded, blunt nose, which diverts the heat away from the warhead itself, and you also have ceramic heat insulating materials, and in these various ways you can get your payload back into the atmosphere.
In other words, a satellite could be used for war-making purposes. It could drop bombs. Seems an awful complicated way to go about it.
The word drop is rather misleading. I mean, if you don't drop a thing from the satellite, you have to bring it down and it spirals into the atmosphere. The drop may take you right around the world, perhaps a couple of times. But the existence of Sputnik 2 is proof that they can land a warhead anywhere they like on the surface of the Earth. I don't know with what accuracy, and they probably don't know, but they can get it down within, say, 10, 20 miles anywhere they like on Earth.
Well, this Sputnik is not outside of the Earth's gravitational field, is it?
Oh, no.
In other words, it still maintains the orbit there.
Oh, quite. Right? I mean, nothing is outside the Earth's gravitational field, and up where Sputnik 2 is, Earth's gravity is still about 90% as powerful as it is here at Earth at sea level. I mean, it's Earth's gravity that keeps it in orbit. If it wasn't for gravity, it would just shoot out into space.
That's right.
There's another question that I also hear in the war-making aspects of satellites. Not everyone, but people seem to be worried about violating air sovereignty and so forth, particularly with the fact that satellites may be going over as observation vehicles, not observation of space conditions, but observation of ground conditions. And I wondered how much observation you could do at 18,000 miles an hour.
Well, the speed doesn't matter, because I have seen photographs taken from jet planes traveling at 600 miles an hour at treetop level that were pin sharp. So the speed doesn't affect it at all. The trouble is the atmosphere and clouds and that kind of thing. But there's no doubt that you could put reconnaissance equipment, long-range cameras, in a satellite, which could give you invaluable information, particularly about the movement of surface vessels, for example.
On the ocean movement?
On the ocean, yes, they could spot all ocean movements, except when there was cloud cover.
There was one thing, speaking of warlike satellites, you didn't mention any of these points, but there was one point that intrigued me considerably in the lecture when you talked about the shrapnel technique.
Yes, how to shoot up a satellite.
Yeah, would you explain that again? That was quite fascinating.
Well, there have been a lot of suggestion that we might build, or somebody might build, space fortresses which could be used to dominate the Earth and perhaps as launching platforms to threaten the world. But I think that if such fortresses were built, they could be destroyed so very much more easily than they could be constructed, that they'd be worthless militarily. And the way you could destroy them easily is this. The satellite, of course, the space fortress, has a fixed orbit, and you know just where it is at any moment. Just going round and round, it'd be a spectacularly visible object in the sky, even to the naked eye, much brighter than Sputnik 2, to be the brightest thing in the sky. If you want to destroy it, all you do is to shoot up into the same orbit, but in the opposite direction. A warhead loaded with old-fashioned shrapnel. And somewhere as it goes around the orbit, it could be on the other side of the Earth from the space fort, you explode this warhead and the shrapnel scatters. It uses quite a small charge of explosive. And it forms a cloud of particles, a cloud of shot, if you like, which will then meet the space fortress head-on twice every revolution, in other words, about every 45 minutes or so, at a total combined speed of about 30,000 miles an hour, say 10 times as fast as a rifle bullet. So if you miss the first time, 45 minutes later, you have another go at it. And every 45 minutes, the space walkers sail through this cloud of shrapnel.
Or the cloud of shrapnel through it, as a matter of fact.
Exactly.
You know, I wish we were half as ingenious at prolonging life and doing something for mankind.
I quite agree with you. I hope, incidentally, that the space stations may help us to prolong life. There's some good evidence for thinking that under low gravity conditions, and of course in a space station you have zero gravity, that men might live longer, and certainly that men suffering from various, perhaps heart disease and muscular diseases, might live normal lives. And I think that the medical results of building space stations may be quite important.
I skipped the point. Didn't you say before that the Earth's gravity was just as strong out there as it is down here?
It's a little weaker. It's still about 90%. It falls off a distance, but very slowly. So at the distances of the present satellites, it's still quite strong. For instance, you have to go out 4,000 miles before it falls to a quarter of its sea level value here.
Yeah, well, you were planning on at least conjecturing a space station considerably farther out than that, then, could be benefited.
That's another thing. In a space vehicle, at any distance from the Earth, there is no feeling of gravity. You're under the pull of gravity, but you don't feel it because you are falling freely. Now, this is a difficult conception, but here, right here on the Earth's surface, you can be weightless. You can have no sensation of gravity. If you're in an elevator and the lift and the cable breaks, you're fully under the influence of gravity, but you're weightless as long as you're falling, you see.
Yeah,
you don't stay weightless for long.
Sure. True.
But in a space station, even if it's only a couple of hundred miles up, where gravity is very nearly the same as it is here, the total force of gravity, you would feel weightless because you are falling freely all the time around the Earth. So you have to distinguish between these two facts. That you could have this weightlessness or so-called gravityless feeling, even when gravity is there.
Why would this be beneficial to our health, or at least possibly be beneficial?
Well, think of all the work we do against gravity here on the Earth's surface, moving our bodies around, climbing upstairs, and this must definitely shorten our lives to some extent.
But what would happen if we had no gravitational pull?
Well, wouldn't I
be floating?
You would float around, and you wouldn't...
How would I control myself, though? In other words, I don't want to go upstairs. I want to stay right here.
Okay, well, I'm afraid you have to have belts, but you have to have seat straps if you want to sit down in one place. But you remember, we can build space stations, so you can have gravity in one part, or a sort of artificial gravity in one part, and no gravity in another part. It's a very simple trick. All you do is you design your space station like a big wheel, and it rotates slowly. And if you adjust the rate of rotation, you can have things so that centrifugal force gives you a normal feeling of gravity at the rim of the wheel. And as you go towards the hub, the center of the wheel, you have no gravity. So you just...
What would happen to all of the objects that we may have, like on a table here, the packages of cigarettes, the microphones and things? Wouldn't these be floating in the air? Or
no,
would they go right to the ceiling?
You have those things in the section of the space station where there's gravity. You have them on the rim of the space station. That's where you do your cooking, and you have your showers, and you prepare your meals, and you sit down. Things are perfectly normal there. But when you go towards the center of the space station, your apparent weight, because you're no longer rotating so quickly, our apparent weight falls off, and at the center of the station, you have no weight.
Now, when we come to
the hub
we would start to float?
You would float around in the hub. That's right.
Well, if we were in a room, then, would I be on the ceiling?
There is no ceiling.
In a room, there wouldn't be a ceiling?
There are just six walls. There's no up or down. There's no preferred direction. In the hub of the space station, there's no gravity. There's no up or down. There are just six walls around you.
Well, what would be the purpose of walking into this hub?
Well, you couldn't walk there, actually. You'd drift. It'd be like underwater. It's like underwater. And one reason why I'm interested in underwater exploring and spend most of my time there is this is the nearest thing you can get to the gravity-free condition of a space station.
Yes, but would you want to live underwater? This wouldn't be comfortable, would it?
I'm only very happy underwater.
You came to the right program,
right,
honestly.
Right. Arthur, is one... One question I would like to get in, I have read, may have been even one of your books, I don't know, not only the various weightlessness phenomena, but the fact that in a weightless condition of free fall, a number of curious things happens, among which, as I recall, is the fact that unless you're very careful, if you're in a weightless condition, you might suffocate in your own breath. Now, what is the function there?
Yes, so the point is that when we breathe out, that the air is heated and it rises away from us normally here on Earth. But in a space station, it couldn't rise because there'd be no gravity. But this is no problem. You simply have to have a very slight amount of forced ventilation. You have to have fans to keep the air changing around anyway. So there's no real danger of suffocating because your exhaled air wouldn't drift away from you.
Quite. Well, now, if you don't have to exert any effort, what about our muscles? Would they not atrophy, possibly?
This could be a danger, but you might have to take a certain amount of exercise to overcome this. But I'm thinking specifically of people who have muscular defects and can't get around, and perhaps even multiple amputees, for instance, might be able to operate, at least men who've lost their legs. They might be able to operate perhaps even better under these conditions than normal men could, because they wouldn't have so much useless weight to drag around.
Well, why? Oh, excuse me, Major.
Major?
I'd like to make a comment on this gravity situation. We always talk about opposing gravity or blasting off into space or neutralizing gravity or the power of the motor and the energy that is needed to establish these space stations and put satellites into orbit, etc. And man has at various times found that it's very helpful to work with the forces of nature. Do you think that there is a possibility that we can learn how to use gravity for power and rather than oppose it, use it like we use water power, you might say, as an energy?
Well, I don't see how you can use gravity, get power out of gravity, but I think we may one day be able to control gravity in some way or neutralize it, but we shall need power to do it. For instance, if you consider the problem of getting away from the Earth, there's a certain amount of power, a certain amount of energy required for the job, and it doesn't matter how you do it, whether you go by rocket or any other conceivable device, there's a minimum amount of energy needed for the job. This is, if you climb over a mountain, if you travel over a mountain, doesn't you have to have do a certain amount of work, whether you walk, whether you travel by bicycle or automobile or airplane. And one day we may be able to control gravity and go away from the Earth much more comfortably and with less flame and fury than at present. But we shall soon need a source of power, perhaps of nuclear energy or something like that.
Arthur, I wonder if you put any credence talking about controlling gravity. Do you know about the experiments of Roger Babson? Is he still doing them, or do you know?
The Gravity Research Foundation.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if he's ever done any experiments. He's set up a fund, didn't he, to collect material on gravity.
Well, as I understand, he had offered a prize for anyone who, quite a substantial prize,
yes,
for anyone who could find an anti-gravitic substance, and that, in fact, at his research center against gravity, I guess you might call it, they were doing a fairly methodical technique of sort of suspending things in the air and holding various substances under in the hope that, you know, like maybe you'd hold a plate of fried eggs under and who knows, maybe it just wouldn't fall that time, and you have it.
Well, there's a lot of work going on in various research laboratories to see if we can find anything about gravity. But an anti-gravitic substance of the type that, for instance, Wells had in his story, The First Man in the Moon, so a gravity shield, it's quite easy to show that is impossible. It violates the law of the conservation of energy. On the other hand, it's theoretically perfectly possible to have a substance which has negative gravity. In other words, it goes up. It's repelled by ordinary matter. That's a different thing altogether. That might be theoretically possible. But a gravity shield is not possible unless it is powered by an external power source.
When you speak of the matter with negative gravity, this gets into science fictional concepts.
Well,
but wouldn't this, as I recall the definition of this sort of stuff, this would be negative matter, as a matter of fact.
It might be.
And if it got together with positive matter, isn't the theory that it would be a big boom? Yeah.
That's right.
It wouldn't be too handy to have this stuff around.
It might not be useful.
I don't know.
It wouldn't render the jointure inert, would it?
Well, if this negative matter met ordinary matter, each would annihilate the other, and the result would make a hydrogen bomb seem a very modest performance.
I've had something working around and around in the back of my head here for the last 30 minutes or so, and I must insist to get this out while Mr. Clark is here. We've had quite a bit of discussion about the Earth, the danger of mankind completely wiping himself out on this planet before he becomes intelligent enough to control the things he has created. Also, we have looked back into history and we have thought about various things that have happened in the past. And the history of the world is not a very beautiful one. It seems like we have had war upon war as long as we have a record of history. And it seems that that many people from time to time have risen to positions of leadership, leading various nations or countries, either as dictators or kings, and down through history have said later that those men were insane because they plunged their nation and they plunged the world into war at various times. We have discussed these various persons who claim that they have had contacts with spaceships, and we have cast around some ideas as to who is sane and who is not sane. And as I look around me on the Earth and think about these things, and think about our nuclear program and our present ideas that we about our next step with the nuclear bombs is to blast a bomb off into space, explode them out 50 miles out, or perhaps one on the moon, and blow bits, hunks off the moon and hope that they will float back to Earth so we can examine them, and things of that nature. And something that George Bernard Shaw said comes to mind. He said that the Earth is the lunatic asylum of the solar system. And I just wonder if perhaps maybe this might be true, that most of Earth people are actually lunatics, and that perhaps the Earth might be off limits to people from other planets, and that that's why perhaps they don't land in the middle of a populated area or contact the president or contact some king or emperor. Because maybe the Earth people are just in such a state of development that they're not safe to contact.
Charles?
I wonder what, to get in this, I may say that Mr. Clark is a unique authority on the ideas of George Bernard Shaw, because I happen to have seen some correspondence from Mr. Shaw to Mr. Clark. And as I recall, Arthur, there were some rather peculiar ideas in this correspondence, weren't there, that Mr. Shaw was putting forth about gravity and vacuum and rocket experiments?
Well, before you answer that question, Mr. Clark, let me just tell our listeners again that this is WOR Radio, your station in New York, and this is Long John with the Party Line.
First correction, slight correction, John. You said that Harper's published my books. Well, they published all my nonfiction, but I have a large number of other publishers who may be a little...
I'm sure. No, okay. You made the statement.
Oh, no, no. Harper's do my nonfiction, but Gnome Press, the Ballantine Books, and Harcourt Brace have done my fiction. As to the points that the Major raised, including his very interesting one about the idea of the Earth as a sort of lunatic asylum, I think that's a very plausible theory. And one of my novels, Childhood's End, was, in a sense, based on this idea that... we are ripe to be taken over and run properly. However, as far as Shaw is concerned, it's an interesting story. About 10 years ago now, when I was still at King's College London, I wrote a paper on space travel and its social effects, and I sent a copy of this to Shaw because I quoted the concluding lines, I believe, from Back to Methuselah, the last chapter of that, as far as mine can reach, is quite relevant to this subject. And Shaw was quite impressed by this paper and wrote back to me. I still have the correspondence, and promptly joined the Interplanetary Society. It was quite remarkable that at that age he would be about 92, I think, then. He was still so active-minded that he was interested in this development of space travel.
Major, any further comments?
Well, I'm just inclined to go right along. This is perhaps the answer why we don't have one land in the middle of one of our populated cities or contact one of our leaders, because the destructive forces that we have built here, enough to destroy all of the civilization on this planet, I think that's pretty well agreed. The question would be, what would we do if we had something further, if we don't learn how to control these things and use our technology for the benefit of society, for the benefit of mankind, rather than for destruction?
I've often wondered, Major Ahol, why it is that so many people who believe in saucers are under the impression that the Venusians and the Martians and
members, or rather citizens of the planet Clarion. Some people are not familiar with that planet. It's behind the moon. I've often wondered why these people who believe in flying saucers are so sold on the idea that the Venusians and Martians are actually interested in doing us only good.
No, I don't. I don't think that that's a general should generally be applied to all people that are interested in the flying saucer subject. I'm rather of the opinion myself that if we're going to grow, we're going to have to grow ourselves. And if there might be such a thing that from this visitation, this touch and go business, touch and go landings, and the sightings and so forth, are merely to arouse our curiosity, so we will learn that there is something bigger, something greater in the universe.
That they're sort of playing a game with us?
That's right. Showing
us
that they exist.
These are intelligent people that are far superior to us as far as intelligence is concerned. And they're running these things around these saucers
just to show us that there is something that we can investigate and
is
learn about.
Is this a display of love for your fellow man and that sort of thing?
No, I think it's a display of a natural law that if you're going to grow, every person has to make an individual effort to do that growing.
Are you talking about individuals now, Major?
I'm talking about
nations?
I'm talking about individuals, and from individuals it becomes families, and from families it becomes communities, and from communities, nations, and an international community.
Right here on this planet, Major Aholt, it seems to me that I have heard from time to time that it's been suggested that we should exchange ideas. In other words, the Russians should give us all of the facts about Sputniks, and we should give them all the facts about things that we know. And if we could do this, if we could exchange ideas and knowledge that we may have accumulated, we possibly wouldn't have wars. At least I've read this someplace, I know. If this is true, why is it that these super intellects who are coming around in these saucers just playing games with us, why don't they come down and give us the facts, you know? Just say, look, fellas, the whole thing that you're doing here is completely obsolete. These little toys that you have, they look like children's kites that you call jet planes and things like that. Why don't they help us?
Well, perhaps, John, it will come to that point. I think that...
why is the great delay? This has been going on for over 2,000 or 4,000, I don't know how many thousands of years. Why is it taking so long before they're going to be kind enough as big brothers to come down and help the stupid people?
Well, let's hang the sign right on man's own ignorance. His inability to examine new things with an open mind.
Examine? What chance do we have to examine, Major Aholt?
We have the chance every day. I'm examining. Anyone else can do the same.
You're examining saucers?
Yes, absolutely. And the road is open for anyone that wants to do the same thing. I know that that many people are making statements about this subject that have not examined very much of the evidence. And they discarded without any examination, said, well, this is all tommyrot.
Well, Major Aholt, in other words, when you say that they're giving us a chance and they have for the past 2,000 or 5,000 years gave us the opportunity of examining these things, do you mean that they've just been flying around and that's the extent of the examination that they permitted us to make? In other words, they haven't actually, or are they landing saucers here that I can go over tomorrow afternoon and take a peek at?
I think that it'll, when we begin to understand more of the picture, that it will tie in with the development of the Earth for a greater technology, the fact that we have become airborne, the fact that we are thinking about going out into space ourselves. Psychologically, now is the time where a man might best understand that there might be life on other planets already. And that he will, when he reaches out into space, he will begin to meet some of that life. But it is obvious to me that the state of conditions on this planet, that if one of these ships and a superior technology fell into the hands of any nation on the Earth that is involved in this Cold War business, that immediately we would want to make war weapons out of these things.
Don't you
think? And again, it comes right down to the same thing, that we have greater weapons of destruction. We have greater capabilities of delivering greater destructive power and so forth in warfare. And until man can overcome warfare, why, a lot of these things are just, they're just taken down rather than up. And I think that we have to learn to control such things as fear and hate and envy and greed and a lot of those things that are human attributes that we just don't seem to be able to get away from. But I think that we're going to have to very soon get away from these, or the civilization is done for.
Well, we've been trying for a number of years. I was just wondering this, though. Don't you think it's rather unfortunate that these wonderful people have permitted us to remain ignorant for so many years?
No, let's not put it that way. Let's say that we have permitted ourselves to remain ignorant. Let's put the blame right on our home doorstep, because someone else cannot educate another person against their will. It's an individual effort, and it will always be an individual effort.
This is an interesting point that I've often thought about. You might argue if these superior beings are around, and as I explained, I don't believe they are, but if they were around, they might in fact hold off, because if you have made contact too soon with a primitive race, you might destroy the morale and spirit of that race in the way that on this planet various backward races have died out after contact with higher races, or at least higher civilizations. I don't believe there are any higher races on this planet. But sort of they get an inferiority complex, a cultural inferiority complex, and die out. This might conceivably happen if we came in contact with a very much superior race to our own.
That's a rather frightening thing.
Incidentally, the question that was raised is if this is a lunatic asylum, this Earth, and our wardens are flying around, all I want to know is, where are the tranquilizers?
Well, I think that there is a point here that's rather interesting. After all, what we are lacking is not perhaps knowledge in physical sciences, material sciences. To me, these things have gone ahead at a tremendous rate, certainly in the last, 30 or 40 or 50 years. Ever since, about 50 years ago when the first airplane was successfully gotten off the ground. But our social science, our spiritual science, has not gone far ahead, nor has it proceeded rapidly, nor in any measure kept pace with our development of physical and material sciences. In other words, man has not learned how to live with fellow man. Now, John asked, why don't the space people come down to us and tell us? We spend an evening, Saturday evening, here in this studio talking about law and order. This is one of the basic laws of the universe. I should tell you, you know vastly more about that than I do, Mr. Clark, after all you studied this. But we must apply that same rule to our own planet here and have the nations of the world live under law and order. In other words, we know much better than we do. And I think this is the problem. I feel as strongly as Wayne does about we've got to do the job ourselves. We've had many prophets. We've had many great men who have told us a better way to live. These words are very intelligent, but we haven't exerted ourselves sufficiently to live by them. How do you feel about that?
I think that's true, and I think that every intelligent race on any planet must eventually come to the point we've reached now. And this point is when they succeed in getting control of sufficient natural forces to destroy themselves. And at this point, a race either does destroy itself, or it gets through its adolescence and reaches maturity, and then it's probably safe, at least against internal destruction. And it would be very interesting to know how many races, taking the universe as a whole, succeed in making this dangerous transition. Even more interesting to know if we will make it.
Well, you know, this story of Atlantis and Lemuria destroying each other, to me, is not at all impossible nor unlikely. After all, the extent to which the speed with which we have developed here in this past half century. And if we keep on at this rate and don't learn to live better, I don't think we're going to see another half century by any manner of means. So for some other civilization prior to this, and perhaps a whole number prior to them, if indeed they existed,
yes,
be likely.
Yes, well, I'm thinking of civilization on other stars, on other planetary systems. I don't believe there'd be any earlier civilization on this Earth, because there would have been some archaeological or geological evidence. And certainly there's been no technological civilization on this planet before. Certainly no civilization ever waged nuclear war, because the evidence of that would be very, very obvious. If there'd ever been, say, nuclear war on this planet, the radioactive byproducts would be all over the place, and we would know all about it.
Even though it happened some 20 or 30,000 years ago?
Even if it happened 10 million years ago.
Uh-huh.
Of course, you know that we've just discovered that Atlantis never existed. These corings from the Atlantic have settled that. These new deep-sea corings have settled that point quite conclusively now.
This I hadn't heard about. What's the story?
Well, there's probably oceanographic work's going on all the time. They've got